Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session for the Mesa City Council for Thursday, December 8th, 2011. First item on the agenda is to review the agenda for next Monday's City Council meeting. Page 2, items 3A through 3C. Good morning.
Council, I'd like to bring attention to two or three of the liquor licenses that are on the agenda. Number 3A, Shell number 74. The applicant for Shell number 74 has an outstanding debt with the city, successor liability. So we're recommending that the council deny that liquor license. Or recommend denial.
Remove from the agenda.
What's the status of that?
We've been trying to work with the applicant, and so far they've been non-responsive with us.
As in non-responsive,
as far as not agreeing to pay,
or they've responded?
No, they've responded.
No.
Yes, they've responded and said no.
They're not going to pay.
They can't pay.
They're not going to pay.
They're not going to pay at this point in time.
Okay.
Recommend denial.
You want to ask the question?
Can you explain a little bit in detail what it means to have a successor liability?
Sure. Mayor and Councilman Richens, successor liability exists when a business is either put into foreclosure or sold and there's an existing debt, and that debt has not been cleared up. That debt follows. You basically buy the assets and you buy the debt when you take over a business. And that debt exists, so therefore it's called successor liability.
Okay.
Okay, so specifically related to this, this party, let me see, Wolverine Retail LLC is the existing, or was the previous owner, correct?
Correct.
The debt is with Wolverine Retail LLC,
correct?
Carioca Company bought this location.
Yes.
And is seeking to have the liquor license basically transferred to them.
Yes.
So you're asking Carioca Company to pay a debt that existed with Wolverine Retail?
Correct.
And until they clear that up, you're recommending we deny Carioca Company the license?
Yes, Mayor.
Okay. So what we're saying is that if somebody goes in to buy an existing business that has a license, that part of their due diligence, just like maybe a property tax lien on the property, would be also a... I'm assuming these are sales taxes.
Yes.
A sales tax, outstanding sales tax. Is there an actual lien against Wolverine Retail?
There is.
Okay. So as part of the due diligence, Carioca Company would have done that, and just like with a property tax lien, where you would have that cleared through escrow when you bought a business or a piece of property. If you're buying a business, you would hopefully negotiate clearing that sales tax lien before you took over the business.
Yes.
Is that an accurate?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, how much are we talking about?
Unfortunately, that's taxpayer and it's confidential information, so we can't disclose that.
Can you give me a range?
Well, actually.
Is it a lot? Is it a little? I mean,
I understand in this open meeting it's not, but,
absolutely.
Is it $1? Is it $50,000, that may affect how I act on it. So I'm not sure that if you're asking me to deny somebody a permit,
it's
it significant or is it small?
Is it what you told me?
Well, no, but I know.
It's not.
Okay, well, I know you can in a public thing. So, but the fact is you're asking us to take legislative action on something, but you're not giving us the information.
I'm sorry.
Well, you may not be sorry, but I'm saying
that's not a great
situation.
But my hands are tied,
basically.
If
we can disclose that information without, then we can do that.
Right.
I apologize. I misunderstood in a previous briefing. I might have confused this with another.
Okay.
It is not significant, but it is...
It's
I think it's the principle of the fact that
right.
it, because it's insignificant, we believe, and that's part of why we go through this process, is that it also gives us opportunity. Remember, this is still going to the State Liquor Board, so we have the opportunity to stand in front of them and say, here's why we don't think it should be approved. Now, the board can decide otherwise.
Absolutely.
This doesn't stop the application going
but
forward.
But it's significant enough that the staff is recommending denial.
Right.
Whether that's
$5
or $5,000.
Whether it's,
right.
you know, okay. 500 or 10,000.
What would we do if there was an outstanding utility bill at the local?
We're doing the same thing. We have the policy now that we go and actually, thanks to one of our staff members in your office, right?
Yes.
Started a year ago, really scanning all of our outstanding obligations with taxpayers and consolidating them, whether you're pulling a building permit now or whether you're pulling a utility hookup.
Right.
We have now the process to cross-reference across the city to make sure there's no outstanding liens or obligations to make sure those are addressed. And that's realized significant amount of revenue back to the city because we've been able to have a comprehensive look even across departments and functions.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
So if I bought a house and it had an outstanding utility bill on it, it's part of my due diligence to find that out, and you guys wouldn't turn on my utilities until the previous owner was cleared up?
Mm.
I'm just curious.
No, that goes with the account.
Right.
Individuals.
Yeah.
So that follows
Councilmember
the individual.
Richards, the utility bill is a little different because of the way the legislation is and so forth on that, but if there is taxes owed, then yes.
Well, and I think that's the question I have, is that everybody, whether they buy a business or buy a property, has the responsibility to do due diligence.
Yes, Mayor.
You know, anything that's publicly recorded, specifically relates to a lien, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for someone who buys a business with an outstanding tax lien and they didn't pick it up. That's lazy. That's negligent. Because you need to know those things before you're going to buy a business. I'm hoping that we're not playing a surprise when somebody shows up and we said, well, you have a utility bill that's outstanding, and there's no way they could have known that. Because if they call you, you're going to say, I can't tell you whether they owe any money because it's confidential information. You know, so it's sort of playing a gotcha. I have no problem placing responsibility on someone who's buying something where there's public record or there's easily attainable information.
So let us do this, Mayor, if that's the concern we have till Monday, let us go and make sure we're all comfortable with the idea that when this transaction to purchase of this business, that this information was publicly available and knowledge accessible, as opposed to after they purchased it, then we come back later and said, oh, by the way,
yeah.
you know, this was due.
I like to collect, but on the other hand, I don't know that it's fair to
say. We don't want to
buy.
Do a gotcha. This is not be yeah. a gotcha. And that's not our intent. I mean, this has to be something they knew about, they should have known about.
They should have known about is
right.
the thing.
And so let us go back and document that to get counsel. If that's what would help for Monday, we can do that.
Okay.
Is that okay?
If you just come
okay.
back.
Sure, we can do that.
So I'm seeing a lot of nodding of heads. And
okay.
I have no problem, and I've dealt with some I've had some personal contact, let's say, with people who did not agree with the city's approach to trying to collect with the sale, or in some cases, it's a party shuts down a business one place, wants to open up another business another place, and we won't issue them a permit. And I've had a couple of situations where people come to me, and I don't feel sorry for someone who walks from a liability in one area and wants to start afresh with a new investment in another area and not pay and stiff us. I have no sympathy for someone like that. I do worry that somehow we inadvertently or even through our policy create a gotcha kind of a thing, because that's not fair.
And we would agree with that.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's why the amount is significant also, because you drag out their liquor sales, you have opportunity cost also. So you're going to forego a bunch of revenue while you're trying to collect a little bit of revenue. So that's, you know, just wanted to, that's why I was curious about what the amount was. If it's $1,000, really, you know, maybe we should just keep plowing forward. But if
we try to be consistent.
Yeah.
I understand.
Okay. Thank you, though.
You're welcome. And I've got one more just to point out, but okay. We're recommending approval for this one. But just so council is aware, on RTO Sullivan's, which is 3C and 3D, they did have some liquor violations where they were fined, but they paid those fines, and they are in good standing with DLLC at this point in time. But I did want to point that out to council. But we are recommending approval on this.
They had liquor violations with the state liquor board.
Correct, and they were
so
fined.
They'll have to deal with the state liquor board on those issues.
And they had fines, and they paid those fines. So they're
just
all clear.
In case that
state.
Issue comes up, you know that we've
right.
researched it and it's all been resolved.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.
Okay, on page 3, continue on 4A through 4C, Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, item 4A. It's not really a library question as much as it's a
bond question in the staff report. It said we had sold library bonds that we had not used, and it was like significant amount of money. I don't understand why we do that or how we do that or why are they sitting in your funds?
Mayor Smith, Councilwoman Higgins, those bonds were sold a very long time ago, and we've been paying interest on them. I've heard two different stories as to why the bonds were sold. I'll try to remember. Normally, Brian Raines would jump up and answer that question. Originally, we had some land, and the bonds were sold to purchase that land. That land was not used for a library branch, and the money came back and sat in a fund, and we've been using the money since then to do things like the chilled water line or capital improvement projects like
this.
So
it would be unspent bonds that had already been sold, not just authorized, but there had been an actual sell. And so there's a balance of those. And so since they have already been sold, we're utilizing that cash.
I'm normally wouldn't sell them. It was for something that kind of back.
Well, typically we'll sell them at a point in the year when with an estimate of how much the projects are going to cost.
Okay.
And it appears now. I'm going to have to call Brian this afternoon. Is
call him and wake him up.
Yeah, tell him to put some socks on. So that we will then. It may be the estimate of the purchase of the property or whatever. We estimate a little bit higher, so we had some balance of bond dollars, even though we sold them at the beginning. And we do this all the time, and we just haven't had any other projects, large projects for the library, to kind of sweep those funds up in the past. So these are projects that
and they can't be used. They're not being used for other places.
We can't. Yeah, right. It's for libraries, but you know, for example, you can only use it for appropriate capital projects. So we couldn't purchase books necessarily. So
the good news is this cleans it out.
This is work.
Finish up that unused money.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Heather. Okay. Anything else for 4A/4C?
Yes.
Councilmember Higgins?
The very next item, Mayor.
4B.
4B. The quotes were kind of interesting. The low bid was like in the 100,000 range, and then the next five or six bids were all $500,000 and $600,000. So that's a huge discrepancy in my book. So do they know what they're quoting on, and do we know what we're buying, or why is that?
Yes, Mayor and Council. The manufacturer that we deal with, Semantic, actually gave a really deep discount to the Arizona vendor. We did a competitive bid, and these are all resellers of the same product. And so a lot of it was acknowledging our existing licensing, and they were giving us that kind of arrangement. But it was Semantic to their reseller. We did a competitive bid, and they did a deep discount. The others are all resellers, and if they don't get that same discount, they can offer the same response to our bid.
It was about five times. That's huge.
It was excellent. Yeah. A lot of it was as addressing the fact that we have existing licensing in this product line.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Page 4, 4D through 4H. Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you. Actually, it's 4C, which is on,
Sorry,
not on those pages.
That.
That's okay.
Back page 3, page 4C.
And I just wondered if this communications, this radio issue is connected to the next Topaz radio issue. Are these?
This is the console, so it's really the equipment in front. So I'll let Alex or Dell answer that question.
It's not related to it specifically. It's just an ongoing purchase that the network would be making regardless of the modification to the IGA that we're seeking.
But, Alex, why don't you also talk about this is also a fairly significant discount than what was anticipated, right?
Again, the vendors seem to be giving Christmas sales this time of year. And the vendor in Motorola negotiated probably a 75% discount. This upgrade was planned in the roadmap for next year and would have been probably purchased with future bond proceeds. So I think the price tag we were looking at in the roadmap was well over $2 million. And I believe we're getting this equipment for about $500,000, if I remember correctly.
$574,000.
Yeah.
So this is just ongoing maintenance on your like you said, your roadmap where you show replacement of
stuff. Yeah, the consoles are the positions where the dispatchers sit. Where they work at, and it interfaces to the CAD system as well as the radio system.
Usually when we're talking about Topaz, so we're talking about the radio system and that communicates out into the field. This is really the console that you would see the staff.
It's like a workstation.
There you go.
It's the workstation, and our municipal services also use it, so there is a portion that's paid by the utilities, and our partners will also be buying the same equipment.
Okay.
So we're probably buying, you know, most likely they're going to come out with a new generation of new bells and whistles.
They're trying to clean out inventory.
That's okay with us.
This
will work for us.
We don't. This serves our purposes, yeah. And we can go into the future with these. We don't need the newest, latest bells and whistles, but they may want to get rid of what they've got because they are coming.
It was planned to move to this, regardless, and in timing now is advantageous to the city.
Gotcha. Well, good.
Awesome.
Anything else on this page?
We
ran out of things on the page. All right, 4D through 4H. Councilmember?
No.
Oh, nothing. Okay. Sorry.
Wait.
Okay. Sorry. No, we appreciate the questions. 4D through 4H. 4I through 5C. Councilmember Finter?
I have a question. Actually, I'd like to take 5C off of consent. I haven't had a chance to talk to folks. My worries aren't about having Rio Verde come into the system. It was more along the lines of governance documents and the previous one that we did in 2008 and the changes to now. And I've just been trying to catch up with that. So for now, I'd like that off, and then I'll work hard behind the scenes to try and get some more information.
Okay. So 5C is off consent. Anything else? Councilmember Higgins.
I did miss an item on 4I. And because I haven't heard from Dr. Sorensen in a long time. And so the question I have for Dr. Sorensen this morning is, it sounds like, you know, why does this break?
Right.
Is this regular, or is it like a maintenance issue, or is it a bad things design? And
you know, I'll tell you, we're not really sure. We had two episodes, and they're different. The first episode, which went to council under an emergency contract last summer, mm-hmm. was for a different type of failure of filters. The same filters, but a different type of failure. There was a failure of the filter caps that we had to replace. This one is actually different. This is a failure of the under drain. And as best we can tell, it was just not put in properly. It was not properly grouted at the time. Unfortunately, of course, it's out of warranty. The company that installed it has come and gone. So here we are some years later going ahead to fix it.
Okay, so it's not like part of it's not a planned failure mode that happens all the time with that design. It's just...
No.
The installation.
Right. And the best that we can tell is that the grouting was just not installed properly. And so basically the entire under drain kind of broke loose from the concrete that surrounds it and floated up.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
How long ago was it installed?
Oh, gosh. About like 15 years ago. It's okay. Quite some time. Yeah.
Not like 5 years ago.
Right.
No,
yeah.
That's...
I can double check that for you, but
it's just ballpark is fine.
Yeah.
When you said it was out of warranty and you said the company's come and gone, I'm just wondering if.
Yeah.
Because usually installation, even if they're not there, it's not a part that's failed. Like you said, it's the installation that's failed. But if it took 15 years to fail.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's.
Yeah. But those things typically, they wouldn't fail if they were put in and
right.
installed.
We normally would not expect them to fail. And the other failure that we had with the other bank of filters was also unexpected. For some reason, there's something about our filters that, you know, the caps just failed. The company that builds these caps claims that they have not had these problems in other plants, so we're not sure what happened in that case. We just went ahead and replaced it instead of with the same caps with additional coal, anthracite, anthracite, sand, and gravel. It's basically a carbon filter, and elected not to replace the caps so that we just don't have to worry about those failures in the future. But this one is a little bit different. It was a grouting problem. You know, we're hoping not to see that again, obviously.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Catherine,
yeah.
While you're here.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about what we did last night? What's
happening? Okay.
Greenfield.
Right.
Just
okay.
Synopsis. We'll get details more later.
Sure. Unfortunately, we had a small electrical fire at the Greenfield Water Reclamation Plant last night.
Small.
Both, Mesa, Chandler,
and Gilbert Fire all responded. It was in our solids building. As best we can tell,
all three responded to a small fire. Good.
Well, which actually is great. Kidding. I mean, you know, we would prefer to have a very significant response anytime there's any kind of incident at one of our facilities. So that's actually a really good thing. As best we can tell, some moisture got too close to some electrical equipment and caused the fire. It did take out one of our electrical feeds, but we're able to power the solids building on the generators. So the plant is back up and running, and there's no problems at this time. So more to come later.
So you come to us, you talk about failures on the filters, failures on the grout, and a failure with a fire.
I know, it's not
Dr. Spencer.
Yeah, well, anytime.
You're just
really
full of good news this morning, aren't you?
It's been a good morning.
She does.
I'm hoping that the day improves.
Yeah. No, nobody, no workers or anybody close to it. It's purely
a injuries,
physical thing.
No, nothing like that. No.
Okay. 30 last night, so.
Right. And I'll have more details as the day progresses, and I'll be sure to get that to you so you know what's going on.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. And 5D through 7A. Okay. Next item is to hear a presentation, discuss, provide direction on the public review draft of the form-based code. Mr. Wesley, I'm assuming you're in charge of this presentation.
Lucky me, and also the Planning and Zoning Board.
I was going to say, would you bring them up here too so we can have them participate with us? Welcome. And just so everyone recognizes, maybe they don't recognize. Ms. Coons, why don't you move over and let's fill in all the seats up to the don't leave any vacant seats. Lisa? Starnett, sir, you want to move down one? We'd like to welcome at least, it looks like, a majority of our Planning and Zoning Board here with us today. Mr. Wesley, if you'd like to introduce them for everyone so they know what's who's here.
Sure. Mayor and Council, thank you. Good morning. We do have Beth Coons here, who's the Vice Chair of the Planning and Zoning Board, so she'll be basically conducting that part of the meeting for that board. And then Lisa Hudson, Brad Arnett, and Suzanne Johnson with us this morning at the Planning and Zoning Board. So we can have this joint presentation introduced both the board and the council to the form-based code that we've been working on for the last year and a half or so, as an addition to our zoning ordinance, provide another option for how development can occur in Mesa. This is largely connected to our Central Maine plan that we've been working on for the last couple of years. We have our consultant, Dan Prolick, here from Opticos Design. Been working with us on this. He's going to make the majority of the presentation this morning, and Jeff McVeigh and I are here to also to help answer any questions you may have. So I think maybe we need mine just went blank there, sorry. Vice Chair Coons of the Planning and Zoning Board.
That's right, Mr. Perry. It sometimes
it happens. She could maybe she needs to call the Planning and Zoning Board portion of this meeting to order also, since it's a joint meeting, and then from there we'll turn it over to Mr. Prolick to make his presentation.
Do the honors.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to be here with you.
Happy to have you.
And we'd like to call our Planning and Zoning Study Session to order.
We are both now in order.
Okay. Well, good morning. Morning, Mayor. Good morning, Council. And good morning, Planning and Zoning Board. I'm going to move the mic a little closer because I'm got a little bit of a cold. But it's always a pleasure to be back in front of you now. It's probably almost been a year and a half since I was last in front of you all. And we've done a lot of work. And I've seen many of you through the workshops we've been doing. But just wanted to walk you through the public review draft of the form-based code and answer questions that you might have as this continues to move forward. It's what's great about every time, you know, I end up being in Mesa every 3 or 4 months, and it's great to see that the downtown is making incremental steps of improvement and evolution. Everything like, you know, I think the Urban Picnic restaurant opened up just as we were here the last time. several new clothing stores seem to be happening. But I think the form-based code can really be a tool to kind of light a fire underneath that transformation or that evolution and that change, and we're really excited about it for that reason. Simplified, streamlined, and predictable. These are three really important objectives of any form-based code we write, and is really a primary objective of the code that we've written for you, and we hope that you feel the same. This is a opinion article that was written just about 4 weeks ago after the form-based code we wrote for Flagstaff was adopted. And I know Roger Eastman, who's the zoning code administrator, was quite shocked and very pleasantly surprised that a positive opinion piece came out in the newspaper after the code was written, because he had it was really based on a lot of his footwork that he had done over the course of the couple years of writing that code. The other thing that I just want to mention as a precursor to diving into the code is we really do see this planning that you all are doing and the form-based code as the tool to implement it as an economic development tool. There really truly is a value in the place that you're trying to create in your downtown, and we really want to reinforce the fact that the form-based code has been a really effective tool to help communities use placemaking as an economic development tool. So my presentation today, just to give you a quick overview so that you kind of know what's in store, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the primary objective of the code. Second of all, I wanted to walk you through the components of the code and answer questions that you might have. I want to invite you to feel free to ask questions as I go through the presentation. I think it's always better that way, so that you're not holding a question till the end. We can actually refer to slides that may be prompting questions that you have. And then last of all, I'm going to actually walk you through some of the specific applications with the regulating plan and the form-based zones and how they are intended to be used in downtown Mesa. So as a first portion of the presentation, I just wanted to just continue to reinforce the concept of making transit transformative. This is the impetus of this effort, is really the light rail being extended into your downtown. And I know that you've seen these images before. The last time we presented them here ourselves was at the workshop that these were generated in. But I wanted to just show them again, because I really do feel that I just wanted to make a couple of points based on these images, because I can pretty much guarantee, as your downtown continues to evolve, that you see this site here in the upper right-hand corner, a really prime opportunity site, will be pretty much adjacent to transit. I'm pretty sure at some point you're going to get a drugstore that's going to want to bring, or some other type of use that's going to want to bring, a fairly auto-dependent format into this location. And I think what I'm just encouraging you to do, and I think what the plan and the form-based code is saying, is you need to maximize the value and the potential of those lots and say, you're more than welcome to come, but you need to be in an urban transit-oriented format to be in this location so that we can really maximize the investment of this transit and the real value that it's bringing to our downtown. And so that's the primary reason that I wanted to show this series of slides, and just reinforcing this great framework of urbanism that you have, but just making it even bigger and better as the light rail comes in and making it a complete neighborhood. I think you all have done a really amazing job of making downtown a destination in terms of the civic investment that has been made and the public uses and the performing arts and museums. But I think beginning to look at the downtown as a complete neighborhood is a really important next step. Make it a place where people are living and working and using the restaurants and shopping all at the same time. So the second part of the presentation is really just walking you through the form-based code and talking about just this intent of high-quality implementation and using form-based code as the tool to get you to that. And it's really a new approach to zoning. And I just wanted to use this slide by simply saying I showed you this slide the first time, and it's basically form-based code is using physical form rather than use as the organizing principle or the framework for the code. And I wanted to walk you through how this, specifically the form-based code that you have in your hands, is doing this. At that other meeting, I also introduced this concept that is often used, this framework that's often used, is urban to rural transect for the framework of the form-based code. And I think you were all had sort of talked about this and were fairly familiar. It's just the most urban on the right-hand side going to the most rural on the left-hand side, which may not be applicable, which obviously isn't applicable to downtown, but it's just really about thinking about your downtown and creating a hierarchy of places, and that becomes the framework for the form-based code. And how that translates specifically to Mesa, as you can see across the top of this slide, you still have these urban to rural transects going from the T3, the being the least intense, to the most intense being the T6. And the T3 really relates to these really fantastic fragments of mostly single-family neighborhoods that you have left, and some of them being historic districts and others not, going up to what we call this T6, which is really the core of your downtown, where we could see the prime potential and the becoming the heart of your community. And what's different about this is we actually tiered some form-based zones down off of that primary 6 transect zone framework, because we like to make sure that in addition to the hierarchy of the scale, we're also making sure that, number one, places can either be designated as neighborhoods, which means that that their primary focus is residential, the primary use is residential. Now, taking a step back, every one of these zones has a certain aspect of mixed use. But as you go from the lower numbers, so that T3, it's sort of less mixed, but then you go up to the T6, which is the highest and most intense, has the most diverse mix of intensity. So the subclassifications introduce neighborhood, a neighborhood flex, which has the same form as neighborhood, but the flexibility comes in a bit more flexibility in the uses, and we typically will zone, sort of map those form-based zones in areas where you're transitioning from a commercial area into a neighborhood to provide an appropriate transition. And then there's a Main Street classification, and I think that's pretty straightforward, that the intent of that particular area is a Main Street form with active and vibrant ground floor retail. So you can see those classifications actually working their way down from that primary organizing principle of the transect at the top. Any questions on that? That's pretty sort of in-depth. And
Councilman Richens.
Yes.
How do you make that, particularly in the T5 flex and the T6 zones?
Yes.
There's a lot of talk about ground floor retail and residential over retail, and I've seen a ton of ground floor commercial flop. How is this code flexible enough to recognize that there are some places that ground floor retail would be appropriate, and then there might be places that we want to have residential that ground floor retail may not be fully appropriate? Do we have that kind of flexibility built in with this code?
Yeah, I think there's really the flexibility is based on the hierarchy as well, where you start at the top or the T6, kind of I'll show you the map here in just a second, but that's really where you want the most vibrant, active, prime ground floor retail. As you move into T5, which goes down the rest of your Main Street, I'll show you in a second,
yeah.
You're still wanting vibrant commercial activity, but there's a wider range of allowed uses kind of within that area, which may get more into commercial. And then the flex kind of gets into the transition areas where the code is actually allowing residential uses on that ground floor, but it's typically in a form that could evolve into commercial uses as the market might demand that in the future.
And that's an interesting part about form-based. We've been sort of having a sidebar discussion here. I think one of the reasons, and it's that commercial on the ground floor has not succeeded, and that's true around the country, is that it's forced.
Yeah.
And when you try to create a ground floor commercial where it just isn't natural, just because it's on the ground floor and there's residential above it doesn't mean it's going to work.
Yes.
So, I we go to our downtown, you already have ground floor commercial. It's natural. Yep. It happens. The idea is, should we go up and include a residential element above a commercial element? Well, that seems to make sense in certain areas. And in other areas, it's just not natural. And I think I went to a seminar once just in the last year that talked about this very thing and why hasn't it worked. Well, it's very simple. You can't force the market. The market will do what the market does. And most of the time, it sounds like a great planning idea, Everyone goes to the planning conferences and they see great, really cool pictures. And there's been some nice buildings built. But unless it's a natural part of the human experience, people will fill the apartments above, the condos, whatever it is above, but they just don't naturally go to that ground floor unless it's in a setting that's sort of conducive to that. And that creates that.
Right. So the look, the form, is what you're getting at then, I think. So you may have it have the appearance of, but allow that broader range of uses. You know, maybe there's a live workspace, or maybe there's, you know, a different kind of housing type on that bottom floor, depending on how it fits into the transect. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to talk a bit more about the use tables in just a little bit, but it is really about providing enough flexibility to let the market demand respond to it, because we have several of our projects right now even whether it be a conventional code or even a form-based code that was written that required too much ground floor retail that was unrealistic, even in the hot market. And now we just need to go back and add that flexibility. But making sure that thinking about the long-term vision of what you want this place to be and make sure decisions that are made or new buildings that are built don't sort of prohibit that long-term vision from ultimately evolving and happening.
Yeah, okay, I like what you said there, ultimately evolving.
Yes.
I think that's the important thing, because aren't we really, with form-based coding, there's a trade-off. We're making a deal. We're saying that the form and how things fit together and how buildings interact both architecturally and from a use flow, we're concentrating on that. And what we're doing is we're providing flexibility so that the market might decide what goes on inside the building. And granted, there are some very, very significant uses that just aren't compatible. You're not going to have an arsenic factory next to in a building just because it's in the building. But on the other hand, you're sort of letting loose and letting the market decide what goes on in that building. Maybe it's commercial right now. It evolves into professional. It evolves into something else. And isn't that really what we're doing with form-based? Is rather than saying, at this line, all of a sudden, this is acceptable, this is not acceptable, on the fringes, I mean in the base, you know, this type of residential versus that type of residential, we're sort of letting loose with that, and we're allowing these things to grow organically because it's based on a long-term vision. And the long-term vision is that if we succeed with the architecture, with the placement, with all that, am I off base in saying that, or is that really does that get to the heart of it?
I think that's definitely the intent. I think we have thought very carefully. We haven't just kind of let the uses go. We thought very carefully about it, but it is with the thought in mind that of defining the range of uses
appropriate. Yeah.
Not necessarily saying
it's not a free for all.
Yeah, no, and that's but we've thought very carefully about it. If you dive into these land use tables, and I have a slide in a little bit that I can talk a little bit about the types of considerations we made.
But in downtown, as we get to that, there's a lot more flexibility because there's a lot of different variety of activities that go on in downtown.
Yes.
I mean, this council has said a couple of years ago in our strategic initiatives that we want, you know, a major initiative is to have for downtown is 2,000 residences.
Yes.
We didn't go in and say what really who's going to live in what residents, but we said we want people, and the market's going to determine what kind of people, where, and those kind of things. So that's within that range you're talking about.
Yes.
And whereas we might go in a very prescriptive manner, say no, you'll have this, we're allowing within this zone the kind of organic type of a growth, as long as the long-term objective is we want people down there.
Yeah.
Is that, am I missing the point, or is
no.
my
No, that's absolutely
okay.
That's right on.
All right.
So let me move on. So just jumping into what we call the regulating plan, which is just the zoning map for the form-based code, the primary intent here, I just wanted to walk you just basically through kind of the general concept behind it, and then later on in the presentation I'm going to talk about some of the specifics. But the intent here is to really focus the largest development in the T6 zone, sort of the core of your downtown, really at the heart of your community. And what this is about is, hope this doesn't rub anybody the wrong way, but a place like Phoenix, you've kind of seen allowing really big development kind of popping up all over the place, and it doesn't create any sort of real sense of place, and it doesn't reinforce a hierarchy of your place in terms of where the heart
We're totally offended that you ream on Phoenix. Okay. That's horrible.
So the T6 zone is really, you know, primarily between Center and Centennial along Main Street, and that's really where the most intense of your development we feel should be focused. Then second of all is just, you know, moving along your Main Street and reinforcing this as this what we call the T5 Main Street zone, and allowing that, you know, to evolve and to go up, but not be as intense in terms of the ultimate height of it as the T6 zone. And then third of all is just thinking about then, and this is really the most challenging part of the planning and the coding, is how do those zones and that intensity then transition into these neighborhoods in all directions around that core? And so you can see then we've kind of did a little bit of brain surgery of actually going really almost lot by lot and thinking about how that T5 Main Street transitions typically to a T5 Main Street flex. So it has the same intensity, but a bit more flexibility in the form. And then ultimately, sort of in every direction, you're then stepping down to the T4, typically a T4 neighborhood, sometimes a T4 Main Street. So you can just see the hierarchy that we're creating, and the form-based zones are reinforcing that hierarchy, both in terms of the intensity of the form, but also kind of the mix of uses, which are getting less and less intense as you work your way out from that core T6 zone. And I'm just going to go through very quickly the list of the form-based code components. I know I went over the list at least in my initial presentation. I just wanted to make you familiar with these. The regulating plan, which you just saw, is the one component. We have the building form standards, building type standards, private frontage standards, thoroughfare standards, civic space, smart growth community plans, which I'm going to mention a little bit because that's a little bit of a kind of in-depth one, and then just the definitions. And so I'm going to walk you through and sort of show you just a snippet of each one of these. So I think it's pretty obvious that one of the other intents of the form-based code is to improve usability, and so it's a very graphic code. For each of the form-based zones, of each of those transect zones, we typically have a 4 or 5 page template. And so this is just a snippet from what you have. So each of the form-based zones, the primary standards and the regulations are really on these two pages, and it really deals with building placement, building form, encroachments, and parking, both in terms of where the location of the parking as well as how much parking is required. And then we also, for each of the form-based zones, we have the land use tables. And as I mentioned earlier, we've thought very carefully about the land use tables, given a lot of thought to this. And a couple of things that I want to mention, I don't know if you want to open to 58.6. I'm not sure how much you want to dwell on this, but I just wanted to mention a few things about how the approach to use is a little bit different in a form-based code, because, you know, there is a myth that use is not addressed in form-based code. It's just not the whole organizing principle of the code. But just as an example, if you're on 58.6, and for those of you here, I just want to T5 Main Street, just because I think that's kind of the easiest zone. That's the zone that most of the Main Street within your downtown is zoned. You know, on this page, what we look at is what we call these use types, which is the larger classification, which is in the lighter gray bar. But in addition to the use, we're also thinking about the size of the use, because the size of the use will also have an impact on the appropriateness of that function in the particular zone. So, for example, in the T5 Main Street, a commercial recreational facility that's less than 3,000 square feet is just an easy kind of default approval for it being appropriate for this area. But at a point where it gets to be bigger than that, there just needs to be another level of approval that needs to happen to allow that particular use to happen. So we think about the size as well as the use, and that's kind of tying the use back into the form. I think that's probably enough, unless you have. I just wanted to mention that in addition to thinking about the use at this bigger scale, we're also thinking about the scale of the use, and I think that also reinforces an appropriateness of the uses within the form-based areas. Any questions about that?
Looking at this, just how was the decision made? I'm just looking at one of the categories here: studio art, dance, martial arts, and it's got P2, which is permitted, but it says allowed only on upper floors or behind an allowed ground floor use.
Yes.
How did you get that specific with that type of use, and what was the thought process behind that?
Yeah, what we have, the intent for those is those are the types of uses that will usually show up in the early stages of a Main Street revitalization. And but at the same time, when you start thinking about the viability of having like an entire block of active shop fronts with retail or food and beverage uses in them, if you allow that sort of dance studio type of use, it'll break up that continuity and make it harder for those businesses to be viable and just make that sort of experience a bit less.
So if someone wanted to come in and do, you know, a dance studio, what you'd ask is, say, put a retail component on the storefront so that you maintain that. You want to use 3/4 of the backspace for dance studio, that's fine. You're just looking for that, the visual and the consistent use along the front.
Yeah, and what we're finding is almost any type of use that would fit into this category really is starting to bring in that retail component to really help the viability of their businesses because they have such thin bottom lines. So absolutely, that's the sort of thing that this code would encourage.
Okay. By the way, if anyone on the planning and zoning, please, you know how this works, just speak up.
So in terms, jumping then to the private frontage types, and what the private frontage is, as I mentioned in the previous presentation, it's where the building or the private realm transitions into the public realm, which is typically the sidewalk or the streetscape. And what the left-hand side is simply the list and sort of the palette of frontage types that are included in this code and applicable to Mesa. And so what the graphic is simply showing you is that for each one of those frontage types, we'll have the description of the frontage type, which is the text on the left-hand side of that graphic page, and then the little white and black diagrams show in black which of the form-based zones or the transect zones that those frontage types are allowed within. So it's allowing each of those frontage types in a specific number of those form-based zones. And then the next component are the building type standards. And just wanted to reinforce that these are absolutely supplemental to the building form standards. So what we're encouraging the developer to do is, you know, they come in and they understand what the building form standards regulate for their lot. The form-based code allows a certain range of building types that are appropriate for that lot, that transect zone as well. And then there's a certain set of supplemental standards. And this particular example is a courtyard building type. And I mentioned in my first presentation that we really feel that encouraging courtyard building types within downtown Mesa is really a fantastic opportunity to differentiate yourself from other communities in terms of the types of places and that you're that the builder and developer might be providing, but also just it's really kind of a no-brainer response to your climate and a sustainable response to your climate. And so the courtyard housing type is one that we're really excited to include and flush out within the form-based code. The next component are civic space standards. And mostly on the right-hand side of the slide here are the ones that would be most appropriate for your downtown core here. But the ones on the left-hand side would be more appropriate to like the T1 through the T3 transect zones that might be applied in larger project areas outside of your downtown core. We also addressed thoroughfare standards, and this has been, you know, I think this is one of the things that was really emphasized as being an important component, because as we're trying to define the character and quality of a place, it's really important to define what the streetscape will look like, not just how the buildings relate to one another. And so we've included a palette of thoroughfare standards that are two different things. They're new streets that could be applied to larger opportunity sites where you're actually the developer would be platting new streets, but they're also standards that could be applied to the retrofit of your existing streets. And these are very detailed. And just wanted to reinforce the fact that one of the reasons that these are important, not just from a placemaking standpoint, but they're also really important from a pedestrian safety standpoint, because the speed of traffic and the sort of level of the percentage of accidents that are fatal in terms of pedestrian auto accidents at higher speeds is really dramatically higher than at lower speeds, which you'd try to encourage in your downtown area.
Let me ask you something.
Yes.
How much consideration was given to the fact that smack dab through the middle of this, you're going to have light rail going through, which is going to define, to a large extent, the thoroughfare standard that's on Main Street? How much was that considered? Was there any discussion with either city staff or Metro on what their thoughts are? I mean, in other words, are we going to have a thoroughfare standard in our code that then conflicts or agrees with what Metro is going to present and what the city is going to present as far as how we design Main Street?
No, it was really a kind of fantastic opportunity, because that street design for Main Street was mostly done prior to us coming in, and we were very happy with the design of that street. So it was just, we were able to just, we focused mostly outside of the Main Street area. We reviewed the streets to make sure that it did meet the intent, and it was a good design. So
you're assuming that when Metro comes in, we're not going to screw it up.
No.
We're going to sort of leave it. Well, that's our intent.
Our
intent is not to screw it up.
Oh.
We're hoping that we take what we already have, enhance, but don't change the nature of that. And I think the plan that's sort of on the table right now doesn't do that, and actually acts as a calming device, which slows traffic down, certainly through the core of downtown area, with which the stakeholders actually supported and wanted to do, where we're going down to the two lanes of traffic from the four lanes and maintaining parking and doing all that kind of stuff, which we were really pleased with, that the stakeholders came out and supported that.
Yeah, I think between the work that you all have done already on expanding the sidewalk in the public space between the curb and the building frontage and the taking one travel lane away, it's going to be a pretty fantastic street. Yeah. Just as one example, in one of the I think it was the third workshop that we did, as we were looking more specifically at the Temple neighborhood area along First Avenue, we did a little photo montage similar to what you saw along Main Street, but just simply showing how you could take this vast expanse of blacktop, which a lot of your streets have that curb to curb, and look at, especially looking at a street like First Avenue, which actually terminates in the Temple. It's a really important and prominent street. And thinking about ways that streetscape improvements could be made to once again create a hierarchy of even the streets within your downtown. And that will be reinforced by the hierarchy of the built form of your buildings as the plan and the form-based code gets implemented.
Alex, were you the one who was telling me? Somebody told me, and I can't remember this, that a long time ago, First Avenue did have this median, just like, I haven't seen a picture of that, but especially from Mesa Drive over, it was very similar to what it's like on McDonald with the citrus median and that. So this is just basically going back to where it was. Okay.
Yeah. So in terms of walking you through a few of the specific applications to kind of tie the zoning map or the regulating plan back to the form-based zones, and as we went through the several design workshops, these are sites that kind of came up that we studied and tested the application of the form-based code. But the first site is between Centennial Way and Center Street, between Main and First, and it's mostly, this is kind of where we're at right now, it's mostly city-owned property. One of the things that people kept telling us is that they were interested in having a large public space in downtown that could be programmed with city events, whether it be the farmers market or other city-sponsored events, performances. So one of the things that we looked at is there's actually a tremendous opportunity not just to create that iconic civic space, but it also, there's a tremendous opportunity on this particular area. You can see here Center Street and East First, and so the post office is just to the left-hand corner there. To think about this as a potential civic complex and even potentially providing a large amount of office space. And so this is kind of reorienting a little bit. And so we're studying the massing of these particular. So this is a little bit turned here. So you have Main Street and Center Street with the existing, what is the name of the building that's right there at the corner?
Mesa City Plaza
building. But what was really amazing about this as we did this study is there's opportunity to do close to 1 million square feet of space on this city-owned property in these few blocks. And so in our mind, these are the types of opportunities that the city could latch on to and really utilize the form-based coding to kind of latch on to these opportunities and latch on to the potential of the light rail and think about these as ways to continue to evolve your downtown with some big opportunity sites.
Well, what's interesting there is that you've introduced a concept which is, you know, we're stuck in like Pepper. We've got city property on both sides, and in this, if what I'm seeing is Pepper is basically abandoned and is filled in with development and becomes part of the property. And I think one of the things we can do in downtown is start thinking of some of these existing minor little streets, especially over on like Site 17. And I've seen plans that incorporate those streets in the plans, and you say, why? You know, you got a clean palette. You've got same landowner on both sides. Why not look at removing some streets, adding some streets, changing some configurations where you have that opportunity? So I appreciate the fact that you're throwing that out there, because I think that's important. Like I said, especially where we own the property on both sides of the property, and we have that ability to go in and do it without upsetting some other private property owner.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was really interesting about this particular study area is if you phase the development, you know, obviously 1 million square feet of whatever city use, office use, is not going to happen all at once, so you could actually phase it such that that bigger block utilizes surface parking behind the buildings in the short term. And at the point it reaches a certain threshold, the parking structures become necessary, but there's enough development that it can pay for that parking structure, so you're not, you know, footing the bill for a $40 million parking structure in day one. So we just felt that that was a really tremendous opportunity and sort of answered some of responded to the interests of the community for a civic space, as well as kind of the need for the city to think about consolidation of city uses, and also providing, you know, potentially some Class A office space for, you know, to attract that big business to your downtown once the light rail comes down here. And this particular image is just taking, it's kind of the replacement for the Mr. Potato Head slide, where we're taking that really generalized sort of massing that I showed in those previous slides and then saying, the form-based code will regulate that form, but then there's a vision and kind of the architecture and look and the feel, the landscape architecture, that the form-based code is not necessarily, it's not controlling because there's no architectural standards in it, but that is another, it's kind of the ears and the head and the tie and what have you, and it's another important part of this, but the form-based code is really focusing primarily on the form that was shown in those previous slides. But this is just a quick illustrative drawing that we did in the workshop of that civic plaza with a city building, you know, framing that plaza. So the second potential application is thinking about the form-based code as a tool for what we call what we've designated as special planning areas. And you can see on the regulating plan, it's these larger gray sites. And we feel that these areas are large enough, complex enough, and really have the opportunity to be game changers for your downtown, that they have the ability to take the smart growth community plan component of your form-based code and kind of take that off the shelf and use this thoroughfare standards and the building form standards and the rest of these form-based standards to actually plan and apply the form-based code and ultimately regulate those special planning areas. And we really think that that's, you know, we one of the objectives of this process was not just to apply the form-based code to the core, but also to allow the form-based code to spread and to be utilized by developers to spread this transit-oriented development throughout the community. Any questions about that? So in terms of doing that, once again, we kept reinforcing this concept of complete neighborhoods and thinking about these special planning areas. And this was just kind of a typical, what we saw could be a typical streetscape along one of the neighborhoods that are being created in those special planning areas. In this particular instance, it's, you know, some really nice two-story townhouses that might have a courtyard space back behind them as a private courtyard space, and narrowly defined streets. And this was just a, in addition to doing kind of the illustrative drawings, we took some of these areas and studied, you know, how the form-based code would apply civic spaces, thoroughfare standards, and this diverse mix of building types and uses to really evolve and transform these areas, because we feel it's really important that these areas, in addition to the main street, develop or redevelop in a way that's reinforcing the transit-oriented nature and the walkable urban nature of your downtown and not in a suburban auto-oriented pattern. So it's not just about an urban main street, it's about a walkable urban downtown. And obviously the urbanism is different on Main Street than it is in these fringe areas.
Well, and when you say the fringe areas, you're talking about as you push out toward University and Broadway.
Yes.
And because I think one of the things that's changed, and this especially comes in as we start considering what's going to happen at places like Site 17, Escobedo, South Center, one thing that I think light rail does change, and the dynamic that it changes, is it seems to compress that urban area, and especially the commercial and growth area toward the light rail line. Do you think the same way?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You want the most intense development, that T6 and the T5, the mid-rise and
right
the high-rise,
the
right
rail.
There. But you know, you also want to provide opportunities for somebody to choose to live in a townhouse and
right.
walk the 7 minutes. I mean, because some people want to live in a condo or a flat, but a lot of other people will want to live in a small courtyard apartment, a small townhouse, and this is still close enough that people can easily walk from that, you know, even to University down to Main Street really comfortably, or, you know.
Now, would you agree, and that's an interesting concept,
yeah.
because someone may live in a townhome, and that's a natural walk. Do you believe that intense commercials pace, do you get the same connection? Will people walk 7, 8, 9 minutes to do that like they will with a house, or is there any connection? Or
There's less of a connection, but there's still a connection, yes.
But less.
We're thinking that there could absolutely be opportunities for both commercial and residential mm-hmm. development because the sites are so large. And so there's really opportunity for both of those. But what you don't want is you don't want commercial development that should be on Main Street to happen in any of these special planning areas. You want to make
gotcha.
Sure that it's that the real opportunities are focused in the core.
And do you think light rail, when you say should be on Main Street, does light rail affect that, or does it
yes.
push things more toward the Main Street?
Yes.
As opposed to not having light rail there?
Yes, absolutely.
I guess the question is, if light rail weren't going down there, would your thought process have been a little different on this?
It'd be a little bit different, but not a whole lot more. It's just, I think what it is because you have light rail, you can get bigger. The idea is you can get bigger.
Because you don't need as much
parking.
And
you might even be able to spread a little bit further, but it makes the most sense for that to be, I guess, both in terms of proximity to transit, but also in terms of you have... In these special planning areas, you have some really amazing opportunity just based on the scale of the sites that you have. And you have opportunities to create these complete neighborhoods that other communities would die to have within a 5-minute walk of their transit area. So what I would hate to see happen is these special planning areas not being planned in a mixed-use way, I guess,
gotcha.
Is probably the easiest way to say it. So.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then also, we had the, it was very fortunate that we were able to expand the form-based code area to the neighborhood around the temple area. And in that particular instance, the form-based code is really seen as a tool for high-quality infill to begin to stabilize and transform those neighborhoods. And, there's sprinklings of vacant lots throughout those neighborhoods. And so we took several of those vacant lots as kind of the tests of the form-based code and said, kind of, what if we replace the existing underlying zoning with the form-based code? And in this particular instance, it was the T4 neighborhood zone. And we just wanted to simply illustrate that the form-based code is encouraging this character and quality of really high-quality living, and this is just illustrating a small courtyard apartment building being built on those three vacant lots that's appropriate in scale, sorry, it's appropriate in relation to the scale of the single family that exists, but it's also providing that variety of housing and high-quality housing that you're wanting to help revitalize these areas and to help serve the access the transit.
And under our current, and the change, so I understand it, is under the current Euclidean, that wouldn't even be an option. You'd have to replace a lot with the exact kind of house that exists next door to it. Or I know that's oversimplifying it, but in reality, that's what it, that's
were,
what it would
there
say.
There were hurdles in place to do this sort of sensitive infill, but there was also incentive added to the form-based code to allow the right thing to encourage the right thing to happen.
So, whereas now it's completely prohibited. You don't even get the chance to. You can go and put a nice house there.
Yeah.
But you couldn't do anything other than what's
yeah.
there.
I mean, for example, even parking requirements tend to be really prohibitive. Mm-hmm. And so we show another version of this where it's on the same lots you could do some really nice quality stacked duplexes. So there's a nice variety allowed. But thinking about parking and setbacks and relationship to the existing buildings were things that we were tweaking as the form-based code was written.
So it still fits in with the nature of the neighborhood. It doesn't yep. detract from that, but it is definitely is a...
Yeah.
Is an expansion of the opportunities you have versus yeah. what we have right now with regular zoning.
Yeah, because what has happened historically here, as with every other historic neighborhood that was upzoned to residential, is you'd get these really out of scale and very foreign large apartment buildings kind of landing in the middle of a block, and then all of a sudden, like, who would want to buy a single family house right. and invest in that? So what we're doing is saying, you know, we're allowing this non-single-family range of building types, but it needs to still be in scale with that fabric that exists.
Yeah, I went through and toured some infill projects that they were doing in Houston, mm-hmm. exactly what you were saying. Older neighborhood, they took two or three lots, they made some some really cool things that yeah. fit in perfectly with the neighborhood. You wouldn't have known that there were like six units yeah. because of the way that they designed it and everything. But they went to a real mix within the neighborhood. It worked really well.
Yeah, and one of the really important aspects of this, instead of relying on a density where a builder might come and just say, okay, my lot's 6,000 square feet, and doing a calculator and punching that, and they've got this number of units are allowed, it's saying, based on the size of the lot you have, this is the range of building types
right.
you can provide. So it's providing that appropriate form based on that lot size or the aggregated lots.
Okay.
So that's actually the end of the presentation. I just once again wanted to reinforce that. I mean, there is a tremendous, I'm sure you see, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity here. And we've been really excited to work on this and to see your downtown already sort of evolving in these baby steps. And we're really thinking that this form-based code can, you know, help that transformation, evolution, but also, you know, taking advantage of the opportunity you have here, whether it be the city-owned sites or these large special planning areas, to really set yourselves apart from the competition that you have in this area and make Mesa, and in particular downtown Mesa, a really high-quality choice for people to come and live. And then, obviously, then amenities follow, and a lot of those services and activities follow as these complete neighborhoods evolve.
Great. Suzanne.
Yeah, I have a question when it comes to the use chart that was shown. You see special use permits, council use permits, and it seems really regulatory. And I wondered, what's the compatibility gauge? How does someone decide what's appropriate and not appropriate?
I think what we were trying to do, and this is the other thing in terms of kind of this streamline notion or predictability, is we're trying to make as much review as we can administrative, so that the planning staff can make the decisions based on the parameters that have been defined in the form-based code. But obviously, at some point, there's going to be projects, whether it be based on scale, the type of use, that need to trigger the public review. And so we've actually thought very carefully about each of the uses and intensities and kind of have gone through and tried to be objective as we can with sort of which projects kind of fit under which type of permitting.
I was looking at the churches, just as an example. What would prevent is one church from going in there and another church being, you know, denied, or just there's too many churches in one area, or what kind of criteria would there be? Because right now, a church wouldn't need much approval to go on a site down there.
Yeah, there's no limitations on terms of like the additive amount of square footage. It's simply based on the square footage of that particular project. Does that make sense? So if a 5,000 square foot church comes in, the staff administers it based on the size is defined here, and then if 2 months later another one comes, where you're not sort of adding up the square footage, just simply based on that one particular use that's being submitted.
And the approval, though, is based on the standards for the property, not on whether it's a church or not. It just falls within that administrative review because it is a church, but it doesn't matter what type of church, what you're saying. The administrative review is based on the property, the size, those types of things.
Mayor, I think it's actually important to note that if you look at the uses right above the church's meeting facilities, public or private, they're exactly the same review requirements as a church. The only reason that we called out place of worship separately is that in our current zoning ordinance, we define them separately, so we wanted to be somewhat consistent between the two.
Well, I noticed the bigger that it gets, you go down to the council use permit, and I understand that because at that point in time, if you're greater than 20,000 square feet, or for example, if you have a K-12 school in a T5 or T6, now you're looking at a use that could
disrupt that
could screw it up.
Right. Yeah. Could disrupt that atmosphere, that pedestrian nature of the street that we're
right
after.
Whereas, you know, a K-12 school, for example, is very appropriate in a neighborhood because those things happen in neighborhoods. Yeah. But in an urban 10-story downtown, you could, you know, because schools here tend to go out rather than up, then what you're saying is that demands a tighter review and the council needs to get involved because now we're talking about its impact on the entire area and the entire plan.
Right. Yes. And again, it's somewhat the use, but that form of that use, as
right
it gets larger, can disrupt that streetscape that you're trying to create. And that's what we're really looking at as much as going to be that design that goes in with that, not necessarily the use, but we did have to classify it according to the use categories we have. So.
Yeah, if a school went up 8 stories, we may think it's just fine.
Right.
If it goes out 1 or 2 stories in a T6 area, would say, no, I don't care what it is, whether it's a school or whatever, it's not in conformity with what we want from the building form standpoint.
Yep.
Okay. Any more questions? Sure. All right. Brad?
I'm good.
Lisa? Ms. Coons? You'll pass. Okay. Any other questions? I'm sorry I ask a lot of questions. In a previous life, I did a lot of this stuff. I think this is really cool. I'm sorry. I actually get excited when I see these things because, you know, I see what these kind of guidelines can create. And, you know, I've helped other cities write high-density infill type things, and this is one step up from things I was ever involved in. So to me, this is great. And I think it's hard right now when you're looking at a book and you're talking about how these standards can really create special things and special places. It's hard to imagine that, but I've seen it happen. I've seen neighborhoods transitioned. I've seen entire areas transformed because of the type of development that came in. And generally, it was a transition between a very old neighborhood, a mature that had seen better days, into more of an urban existence, more density, which normally people shy away from, but which in those situations, and in our downtown I think is the same, is really the key to creating that sense of place.
Yeah.
But you got to do it right. Like you said, you can't just plop down apartment complexes or this here there. It's got to be part of a long-term vision, but boy, when you do it right, it works. And yeah, and so I'm real excited about that. Been around the country, like I said, I've been to gobs of places that have that are ahead of us because their cities are older. Their development is happening a little bit earlier, but I've seen incredible things happen. We can make that happen too in Mesa, so I'm real excited about that. Vice Mayor.
Just a comment. I'm looking forward to the public comment period and seeing what comes back in it. We're sitting on a diamond in a rough potentially. And the reason I can say that is I had the privilege of visiting a community not too unlike ours. It was in Mountain View, California. And you know it because I can see your head bobbing up and down. Either that or you're falling asleep. So, it's both. But Mountain View, California, there are a lot of similarities there in size and population. They have a great job base there. But one of the key issues is, and a former council member in Goodyear was lived in that area. And he remarked to me one time that after he had moved away from there, he would have gone back. And somebody said, let's go out to eat. We'll go in downtown Mountain View. And he says, you would not go to downtown Mountain View. There was nothing there. Yeah. And the area was struggling, and he said, "No, you got to see this." And after it had been about 10 years, he went back there, and the place was bustling. And so I had the opportunity to go there a few years back for National League of Cities meeting, as a matter of fact, and it's incredible. And some of the parallels are the type of the one-story retail like we have. They have light rail that comes along to their main street, which we are going to get. They didn't have any housing downtown, but that housing started to develop, and they put a focus on high-quality uses. They put a focus on their main street and adding some flexibility, which this code does. They had a really neat feature where the owner or the occupant of a of one of the businesses downtown could decide if they wanted on-street parking because they had it there, just like we do in our downtown. They could do on-street parking, or they could block that off. If it's a restaurant, they could, I think they were charged a fee by the city or by the owners, and then they could use that as seating area, and most of the restaurants use theirs for seating because they had parking in the back, which we have parking in the back. So it's very interesting. If anybody wants to see what could really happen and how you can class things up and create a sense of place, is to look at what Mountain View, California has done, an example. And I hold them up as an example, and I hope that's a direction that we're heading with this, that this will certainly add some high-end stuff to our downtown area and a lot of excitement. So thank you for the presentation.
You're welcome.
So, Mayor, just to finish up, we will, with this presentation now and having the public review draft available, begin a more active outreach to the public, getting public comments, working with the Planning and Zoning Board in more detail through the code, and then be back to Council sometime in a few months to see about adoption.
Okay. Anything else? Any questions? All righty. Thank you.
Thank you.
You want to terminate your meeting? You're terminated.
You are terminated.
Thank you. Thanks to the Planning and Zoning, Suzanne, Brad, Lisa, Beth, thank you. Thanks so much for your service. Reports, Owen, we'll excuse Councilman Richens. He had to leave to attend a meeting over in Phoenix. So
we could have fun, have the police chief go arrest him.
Yeah. Reports on meetings and conferences attended. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to report on two events that involve very positive activities by high school students in our community. As you know, we're having a holiday toy drive in District 3 for that will culminate in a pancake breakfast this weekend. And East Valley Institute of Technology is in District 3 and decided to take an active role in this project. And the student council at EVIT decided to allocate $1,000 of their own money to buy toys for kids for Cardin Children's Hospital. And so last Friday, I had the privilege of going with their student council members when they went shopping for the toys, and their enthusiasm for the project was just remarkable. It had been suggested to their student council that could they spend $100 for toys, and they said no, we're going to spend $1,000. And so that was just a wonderful community response from EVIT. And then Saturday I had the privilege of serving as a judge for the We the People competition for Congressional Districts 5 and 6. And we had great participation from Mesa Public Schools, Mesa High School, Red Mountain, Skyline, as well as other really fine East Valley schools. And I can tell you our Mesa schools did a wonderful job. At least in my unit, the question that they were discussing had to do with the Bill of Rights. It was very interesting. It was very interesting to hear their take on how the Bill of Rights has influenced other countries and activities, and many of them brought up the Arab Spring this year. And I thought our students did a wonderful job. And for those of you who don't know, the city of Mesa and its schools have a great tradition in this program, which we hope will be continued by Congress. It's subject to funding cuts as well. I was very pleased to see Superintendent of Public Instruction Hupenthal there to act as a judge, and some of his chief deputies, and they very much, I think, stepped up to the plate and want to help partner with the federal government to keep this program going. So it was in those 2 days I saw some of the best and brightest of our high school students serving in their community. So it was a wonderful experience. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for that report. Councilmember Higgins.
Yesterday I had the opportunity to play kickball and wiffle ball at Sunshine Acres with 8 of the Chicago Cubs players. So the Cubbies went out to hang out with the Sunshine Acres kids, and we had a wiffle ball team and a kickball team. They are much better at baseball, I must say. And then they all came and had dinner with the kids in the dining hall, and they just had a blast because everybody had hats and everybody was signing stuff, and it was just so much fun to see these kids. And they said, "Will you sign my stuff?" Because, of course, I had my Cubby uniform on. So I was a star, too, signing everybody's stuff. But they had a great time, and the Cubs are doing a lot more things like that, getting out in the neighborhood and doing more community service. And they're having a great time. The players had a lot of fun. They're all the younger guys that are here now.
Cool.
It was very cool.
Thank you. Vice Mayor.
Mayor, I met with representatives from DMB. DMB holds the vast majority of the property out in the Phoenix Mesa Gateway area, and we were involved with them quite extensively putting together plans for development out in that area. They also own the First Solar site, as you're well aware. They brought to me their plans for, granted these are residential communities, but I thought I would let you know that we met, and they showed me some of their ideas for how they're going to make this an upscale, well-designed, well-developed community. You know, I don't get excited about residential development, particularly in that area, too much, but I gotta tell you that DMB is the right partner. I was very impressed with the plans they had, and for council, if you're interested, I would very much recommend that you take a look to see what their plans are. Also, Mayor, you'd be interested to know, while I can't divulge what the use is, I know you're a big fan of interim uses, and they have a rather interesting one. If you haven't heard about it, you might want to call them up and ask what that is, but that may be coming forward in the near future on a piece of property that we had identified for more of that urban scale, and they see a potential for a 5-year contract on something that will it will bring a lot of visitors to Mesa for the next 5 years. So it's rather an interesting use, and cool. So I recommend you check it out.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Ms. Kent.
Thank you, Mayor. The Sustainability and Transportation Committee meeting that was scheduled for today has been canceled, and we're looking at rescheduling that in January. This Monday, the 12th, we will have a study session followed by a city council meeting. Tonight's our next Building Strong Neighborhoods meeting for District 3, and this will be held at Jordan Elementary School at 3320 North Carriage Lane from 6:30 to 7:30. And then this Saturday from 8 to noon, we have another household hazardous waste collection event at our Center Street facility at 2412 North Center Street. And Councilmember Kavanaugh already mentioned this, but I'll Plug It Again from 8 to 10, District 3 Pancake Breakfast, and Toy Drive at Fire Station 207, which is 2505 South Dobson Road. And free pancake breakfast, and please bring a new toy for the youth in our community. And the Mesa Arts Festival is this Saturday and Sunday from 10 o'clock to 5 at our Mesa Arts Center. And there'll be live entertainment, children's activity, food, and certainly unique gift for the holidays for purchase. So hopefully we'll see you there.
Councilmember Higgins.
And one other activity, a Boys and Girls Club event at Bass Pro Shop this Saturday. Anybody have details? No? Okay. A little fundraiser, a little get out and support the Boys and Girls Club at Bass Pro Shop and do some Christmas shopping at the same time in Mesa. Thanks.
Buy a Bass koozie that you can put a drink in for your
whatever
favorite
you
person.
Yeah.
Large mouth. It's great.
Okay. Spend money. Lots of it. In Mesa.
Ms. Clark, do we have any requests to speak?
Like I did yesterday.
I entertain a motion to enter into a executive session. I have a motion from the Vice Mayor, second Councilmember Kavanaugh. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are now moving into executive session. Thank you very much.